will set in with a vengeance through Thursday evening and into Friday, with gale force winds driving it in. There are warnings out on the website for that, but there's a potential as it starts to clear southwards through Friday evening and overnight that there could be some snow even at lower levels for a time, and that rain will drag its heels on clearing from the south by Saturday morning. At least some rain for southern areas. Steve, back to you.
Helen, thanks very much. Now on BBC Radio 4, our book of the week. In 1997, Margaret Thatcher invited Charles Moore to write her biography, on the understanding that it would not be published until after her death. In today's extract, Margaret Thatcher's political ambitions are almost derailed in 1971 by the issue of school milk. First, though, we return to 1952, when Margaret Thatcher is newly married to Dennis. Nicholas Farrell reads from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography.
The first surviving letter from Mrs. Thatcher, rather than Margaret Roberts, dates from the middle of February 1952, 2 months after her marriage to Dennis. Margaret informs her sister Muriel that the couple's planned first cocktail party together is postponed because of the death of King George VI. Although perfectly content in tone, the letter is certainly not ecstatic. It is practical, and its main theme, as so often for people in London, even well into the 1950s, is shortage. There is an egg famine in town, she declares, and she wants to buy some eggs from Muriel and Willie's farm on a strictly business basis. She has also been in search of clothes. I've got the turquoise set from Peter Jones, but the only pleated waist slips they have are in that rather violent pink. She is starting a law course. 10 weeks for 3 days a week. The death of the king gave her the opportunity to set out her views of what the new reign should bring for her sex and generation. In an article entitled Wake Up, Women, in the Sunday Graphic, Mrs. Thatcher announced, "If, as many earnestly pray, the accession of Elizabeth II can help to remove the last shreds of prejudice against women aspiring to the highest places, then a new era for women will indeed be at hand." Her first law exams took place in May 1952, and she was called to the bar in 1954, but in between came motherhood. Her baby was expected on the 29th of September 1953, but early in August, Mrs. Thatcher, who had experienced quite a difficult and exhausting pregnancy, suffered labour pains and went into Queen Charlotte's Hospital in London. The doctors told her, which she had not previously suspected, that she was carrying twins and that they were on their way. They were born by caesarean section then and there, a girl, Carol, and a boy, Mark. Each weighed 4 pounds. According to Carol, Dennis's reaction to the first sight of his children was to exclaim, "My God, they look like rabbits, put them back." And there is no doubt that he was not immediately attracted by babies. Mrs. Thatcher was pleased to have twins, but more because it meant that she need not get pregnant again than because of a wild enthusiasm for motherhood. "Neither of my parents," wrote Carol, "could be described as being natural or comfortable with young children." By her own account, Mrs. Thatcher was almost frightened by the emotional impact of the birth, the miracle of life sharpened by the perils of prematurity, and she realized that she must keep the idea of a career constantly before her eyes. "I needed a career because, quite simply, that was the sort of person I was." She decided, despite her new burden, to go ahead and sit her bar finals. Although it was not in Mrs. Thatcher's nature to subject her children, or indeed the rest of her life, to close emotional analysis, her letters to Muriel disclose vignettes of character, small judgments, scarcely considered as they are made, yet still significant. "Mark and Carol had a bit of a set too," she wrote, "which resulted in Mark being pierced on his arm by a gardening fork." At Christmas 1957, Mark liked his present, particularly because it had bullets in it. Mrs. Thatcher was frightened of boredom and what she called vegetating. House proud and fond of her family though she was, She associated the danger of ennui with the life of a housewife. In 1959, she told the Evening News that, "I should vegetate if I were left at the kitchen sink all day. The twins are at school, and in any case, I have a full-time nanny. I don't think the family suffers at all through my political ambitions." In old age, she came to recognize that this was a fiction, and she worried that the family had suffered far too much. But the fiction had been a necessary one, for Margaret Thatcher knew perfectly well that she had to have an all-consuming career come what may. She could never contemplate abandoning it. Another effect of Margaret's marriage to Dennis was a growing separation, though never an estrangement, from her sister Muriel and from her parents. Mrs. Thatcher was now moving into a world which was a combination of professional Chelsea and semi-suburban, highly conservative Kent. Pursuing their au bourgeois dream, and driven out of Chelsea by the Tory government's ending of rent control and the needs of the twins for more space, the Thatchers moved to Kent. The house was called Dormers and stood in a suburban cul-de-sac. The house gave the twins their nearest approximation to a permanent home with which they could fall in love. Margaret herself literally put down roots. She became manic about gardening and grew dahlias the size of dinner plates, while Dennis became a keen mower, declaring daisies public enemy number one. For Margaret, it was a long way, on the whole a pleasantly long way, from life above the grocer's shop in Grantham. Margaret Thatcher entered the cabinet for the first time as Edward Heath's Secretary of State for Education and Science on the 20th of June 1970. During her time at the DES, she did not feel among friends. In her memoirs, she describes the prevailing atmosphere there as self-righteously socialist. This slightly edgy relationship with her own department helps to explain the fiasco which made her a household name for the first time and came quite close to aborting her political career. One of the first actions of Edward Heath's new government was to inaugurate a review of all public spending. Mrs. Thatcher immediately applied herself to this, whilst resolutely fighting her department's corner. She was determined to increase the DES budget. Her tactic for doing so was to accept cuts in non-educational aspects of her budget in favour of increases in truly educational spending. The Treasury's attention focused on abolishing the long-standing provision of free milk to all primary school pupils for their morning break. The previous Labour government had abolished the milk for secondary school pupils. The Treasury calculated that the saving on the milk would be £9.5 million in 1971-72. While happy enough with the general drift, Mrs. Thatcher proposed that milk still be issued to children up to the age of seven, and she suggested that the savings made should be redirected into the school rebuilding programme. The issue was discussed in Cabinet, and she was judged to have handled matters well. Even The Guardian spoke of a remarkably light raid on the education budget. Problems, however, began to grow. No one had raised the political dangers. By May 1971, it became clear that opposition had grown. On the second reading of the bill in June, Ted Short, her Labour predecessor at the department, called the legislation mean, squalid, and unworthy of a great country. Nutrition experts, social workers, the NUT, the Child Poverty Action Group all pitched in against Mrs. Thatcher. Here was a subject on which everyone could easily have an opinion, and where the case for the cut, however reasonable, could never seem attractive. The Sun asked, "Is Mrs. Thatcher human?" At the Labour Party conference that September, a floor speaker coined the phrase, "Mrs. Thatcher, milk snatcher," and it quickly became the only thing that most of the public knew about her. All this fuss was peculiarly painful to Mrs. Thatcher. It was her first experience of being hated for her public work, and it cut her to the quick that people should think that she, a mother, could be indifferent to the health and happiness of children. Her speech establishing Liverpool Polytechnic was cut short by protests, including cries of school milk. By November, The Sun marked her down as the most unpopular woman in Britain. The attacks produced an uncharacteristic self-pity. In an interview with The Guardian, she burst out, Why are you doing it? And she earned a rebuke from the Daily Mail columnist Jean Rook. Show some spunk, Margaret. Remember flaming Barbara Castle when she came back at critics like a blow lamp? Advice which she took to heart. What also drove her on was the conviction that the policy was, in essence, right, and that her opponents had low motives. The idea that most people couldn't pay a small amount for their children's milk was to me utterly ridiculous, and it showed up those who were using it not really about school milk, but to try to get me out of education. People who knew her in the 70s often remarked how tired she seemed and how upset by attack. Milk was her first really big test, and she did not pass it easily. In January 1972, Britain was embroiled in the first of the Heath government's miners' strikes, and the media lost interest in milk. It was at this point that Ted Heath, showing a concern for which Mrs. Thatcher always remained grateful, took matters in hand. Heath could have decided to sack her, and there had been rumours that he was thinking of doing so. Instead, he backed her by getting more money for her department. From now on, Mrs. Thatcher would concentrate instead on those areas on which people could agree. More primary schools, further education, more polytechnics, raising the school leaving age, an expansion of nursery education, and a white paper to set out the bright future. Heath praised Mrs. Thatcher in the House of Commons. She used this and her private knowledge of his support for what is nowadays called a relaunch. A spate of press interviews presented her as someone who had learnt from her ordeal and bounced back. She emphasised her ordinariness. "Whenever I go over a school, the teachers always say to me, 'You're not at all how we expected.'" As a political tactic, Mrs. Thatcher's readiness to shut up and spend worked well. Ted Heath, increasingly beleaguered with economic and industrial problems, was happy to have quiet on the school's front. The educational interest groups were placated, and it became known that Mrs. Thatcher was persistent in arguing the case for better pay for teachers in Cabinet. The department began to feel at ease once more. At a press conference, Mrs. Thatcher said, "Most of you must have felt that I have had very little hard news to put before you." This quietism had been intentional, and it had succeeded, but it is doubtful if Mrs. Thatcher enjoyed it. She found herself almost bored and would have liked to have moved jobs. Her emollient tactic had ensured her political survival, but the price, the loss of her distinctive voice, was high. Interviews and speeches of the period show her adopting a banal goody-goody tone which does not suit her character. The Guardian was now praising her for being more than halfway towards a respectable socialist education policy. For the first and almost the only time in her political career, Mrs. Thatcher started to face more attacks from the right than from the left. Privately, she felt that the school curriculum was going off the rails, but in public, she became bland. Her period at education after 1972 is the only time in her career when her contributions in the House of Commons largely lose their combative tone. She became the loyal, careful, and on the whole strictly departmental spokesman of a government that found itself in more and more trouble.
Nicholas Farrell continues to read from Margaret Thatcher, the authorised biography by Charles Moore, at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 2nd of May. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Rockall and Fair Isle. The general synopsis at 1800, low, Norwegian Basin 996, expected 110 miles north of Norwegian Basin 999 by 1800 Thursday. New lows expected Hebrides 1005 and just west of Shannon 1010 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, westerly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first, becoming variable 4, then southerly or southeasterly 5 to 7 later, perhaps gale 8 in Viking. Wintry showers, rain later, good occasionally poor. South Utsira, north 40s, westerly 4 or 5, becoming variable 4, then southerly 5.